From New York City, this is Conversations, Heist Nobiety's podcast series discussing topics and trends with the people shaping today's scene. I'm Taj Reed.
And I'm Jeff Carvalho. Today on our program, the state of streetwear retail.
Jeff, 2015 was a year steeped in challenges for many of the brands and retailers we've grown familiar with here at Heist Nobiety. A shuffle in revenue and relevancy, alongside changing consumer demands, the internet, and the rise of the new independent streetwear brands pulling market share made it one of the more noisy years in recent memory. Simply put, it was tough goings for a lot of our old buddies last year. We needed to hear from industry insiders on the challenges facing streetwear, and where better to start this conversation than at a gender trade show in Long Beach, California, which, for many retail buyers and brands, is the first North American wholesale show of the season. Jeff, your questions, not so simple.
So what did 2015 look like for streetwear and the independent shops who've been catering to the market for decades? Here's Dion Point. He's with Concepts, a Boston retailer that's been in the game for the better part of two decades.
I think the general consensus that, you know, business is booming for everybody, but the fact of the matter is there was just too much going on, whether it be the amount of product, collaborations, quick strikes and such. It was more saturated than it's ever been.
This large-scale introduction of new brands and product collaborations didn't only reach independent retailers like Concepts. Larger, well-established brands also felt the pain of a saturated market.
You know, we came into 2015 with a pretty diverse portfolio of different stores that we sell to.
That's Brian White, VP of North American Sales for Nixon. You probably know their watches. They rode 2015 by leaning heavily on a segmented sales approach.
It's almost like having stocks when you are able to leverage one market if another one is weaker. Coming into 15, our expectations were pretty grand. You know, we built programs that we had never done before. It's our first year that we segmented the brand. So essentially, we're going after three unique markets to achieve, you know, what we wanted for growth. And each one of the markets, you know, limped a little bit and weren't quite as healthy as we had imagined them. So we needed all of our initiatives, you know, to land the year successfully.
From the retailer's point of view, I definitely don't think the blame is on us about where the market is. Every brand takes their business in their own hands and makes their own decisions.
Here's Omar Kimbao. He's been working in the fashion industry since 1995. And for the past 11 years, run Commonwealth, a contemporary streetwear retailer with shops in Virginia, Washington, D.C., and most recently, Manila, Philippines.
This culture started out as a hunt, as a very, like, in-the-know crowd. And again, that's pre-internet, where you could find out about anything and the history of it instantly. Where we come from, or where our point of view started, it was very earned. And a lot of people don't earn, they're not earning that right now. And so the brands had to take it into account, like, hey, for them to survive, for them to get bigger, they decided to go mainstream and sell to chain stores or people that didn't share that initial point of view. Now they're upset with themselves, but they're kind of to blame themselves. Now these younger guys, they still have that independent mentality. Like, whether or not the bigger streetwear brands want to accept it or not, they're not really indie. They're not really counterculture. They've become the bar.
Omar also touches on one overbearing factor in the contemporary streetwear market. The goods, once solely available from small independent shops like Concepts and Commonwealth, moved into larger big box retailers.
Has that played a factor in the saturation of the market or even the so-called death of streetwear?
But Jeff, is streetwear actually on a downslide or even truly dead? Or is there something new happening, an evolution in the industry? We asked Aaron Levant, founder of Agenda, that same question.
I would say that they're probably wrong if you ask me if streetwear's on the downside. What they're really referring to is those particular brands are losing market share, but it's not down in the overall dollars people are spending. Those dollars have been fragmented and spent in other places. In the very beginning, we had widely unknown up-and-coming brands, like I think you could say like a brand like The Hundreds. When we first started the show, they came out around the same time as us. As the show grew, they grew, right? So there's like this certain class, as I like to call it, of brands who kind of, you know, we were in the freshman class and they kind of came up, and now these guys are, you know, dominated the market for many years. And now I see a new class of brands coming up. They're coming up and they're growing and they're gaining market share, except the business model has changed in that time. When I started Agenda, the only outlet was wholesale. That was 13 years ago. And as we progress forward on that timeline, selling direct to consumers through your website became an avenue for brands. Some brands opened up their own brick and mortar stores. Obviously, other online retailers are pretty prevalent, and even people selling to Amazon on bigger levels. the biggest change is not necessarily the ways to sell, but the ways you can market your product. Social media, Instagram, I think being the number one. Some kid can literally come up with a great idea with very little capital, market it through social media, put it on his own Shopify store for very little money, and the barrier for entry has been lowered so more people can play and get in.
It's clear that the landscape has changed for consumers, retailers, and brands alike in 2015, but how does that play into 2016?
In the second part of this conversation, we sit down with Bobby Kim of The Hundreds and Kyle Ing of Braindead, two brands that reflect the new and old guard of what we'll refer to as modern streetwear.
Jeff's conversation with Bobby and Kyle, also recorded at Agenda, covers a good amount of ground in trying to explain the dynamic between streetwear's influence and inspiration today versus the world that was just a decade ago.
To remain true to the conversation, we've left the majority of this interview unedited.
Yeah, I mean, this is really what's going on. It's affecting not streetwear, not just fashion, but everyone I know is... unless you're in tech or you're in weed, you're going through something. Even if you're growing, you're not growing as fast as you should
right.
be. This is purely talking economic, margins, finance, which is apart from streetwear, I understand. But if you're looking at it from, we're here at Agenda, and if you're looking at it from how can an industry thrive and become an actual operative business, it was hard last year.
The one reading of the story that some people took was very much literal, right? So they saw you they saw you talking about this idea that streetwear itself was dead or was going downhill.
And that's not how I meant it. You want to know how this article happened?
Sure.
Kevin and I, you know, we have a good rapport. We were just kind of doing a State of the Union email exchange back and forth. How are you doing? And I was like, hey, man, this is what's been going on in my business. And I know everyone around me is going through it too. But nobody wants to talk about it because it's uncomfortable. But also streetwear is fueled by so much ego and pride.
Sure.
That nobody really wants to address that elephant and be like, yeah, man, it's been a little bit rough this year. But they'll do it behind closed doors. And I've never really had anything to hide or prove. Like, I don't really care. Probably from a business standpoint, it wasn't the best idea to go out there and say, hey, we just had one of our worst years ever. But I don't really care. Like, if it means that I can educate and inform people
sure.
on what's happening within our business, like, I have a responsibility, I feel, to not just my customer, but streetwear in general, to talk about all facets. Like, I'm usually the inspirational cheerleader, rah-rah guy, like, yeah, you can do it, and every kid should start a brand, and they should, and I believe that. But I also have a responsibility to be like, hey, guys, look, sometimes it gets hard, and this year was hard, and these are the realities of going in, of turning any creative entrepreneurial dream into, like, a real business.
I mean, I think the big thing this year especially was, like, the idea of, like, especially Kanye West being, like, the main influence in everyone's life nowadays. I think when you look at, like, Virgil and all these guys, which I actually, like, support, and I think it's really rad, they've kind of mixed street culture in, like, punk, everything that we kind of grew up as, like, being punk kids and, like, doing stuff DIY lifestyle and, like, all this stuff, like, wearing pins, wearing hats, wearing patches that represented something. It was all about culture always. And when you look at what's happening with, like, Kanye and all these guys, they're getting influenced, but the kids who are looking at what they're doing don't care about the real authenticity of the culture. They just really care about the style because they're looking at tumblers and
sure.
all these reference imagery. And I think what that does, it really kind of like takes away from the whole idea of what streetwear was, which was about culture. Like
right.
what you wear was more of a badge of honor or a badge of like who you are as a individual.
Sure.
You know what I mean? And that's totally gone now.
I actually have to disagree a little bit on the authenticity part of it, right? Because I think if you look at other cultures outside the United States, if you look specifically, I don't know, to Asia, where you can bounce between scenes, right? You can be a kid that's into pop music one day and you can bounce into something else and there's no repercussion to it, right? I think where we grew up, at least where I grew up, if you were...
And when we grew up,
you know, when you did this kind of flip, you were seen as a poser sometimes. Today, I think that that's a little less true to what's happening. So they're taking it all in from a style perspective, but is that not still influenced from all of the roots of what it was, you know?
I mean, at some point, I mean, like, I think growing up, like, being into music and being into skateboarding, like, I would watch a skate video and be like, oh, I love the way this guy dresses. So I dress like that dude. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I was looking at Daniel Shimizu and all those guys because he was, like, a Asian dude wearing cool clothes. You know what I mean? Yeah, he was like a rocker, you know what I mean? And that was sick. But like the thing was like I was still skating, you know what I mean? And I think it's you don't have to skate to wear Supreme. I'm not saying that. But what I'm trying to say is the fact that like when people are starting these brands, like if you're starting a brand, you're putting it out there, especially in streetwear, that you have a perspective in culture, in my opinion. Or you'd be a fashion brand. Or, you know, nowadays with H&M and everything, I feel like a lot of these brands who are considered streetwear, they're just making like H&M brands, like who can make this like moto jean for $60.
Sure.
You know what I mean? It's a battle of price because of fast fashion. But I think the thing with street culture and streetwear, it should always go back to real culture. And that's what makes it streetwear. So like, you know, even like when you talk about Bobby, like when he started the blog and everything, you know, there's so much respect because he was always putting out his own perspective, whether you liked it or not. And he made clothes based off that because that was like, hey, I read the hundreds. I'm going to wear the hundreds t-shirt.
Sure.
You know what I mean? And I think the problem is he became very successful. And a lot of people became very successful over their own identity. But I think the problem was that from that, everyone was like, hey, man, if I just copy or duplicate these looks that other real guys who are doing it right or doing it kind of like these pioneers, we can make money.
Sure.
And I think, you know, end of the day, when you're on a Tumblr or something and you're seeing, oh, that looks like this, they don't care what the original was because our kind of the way we digest information has totally changed.
So for an audience that's coming up today, like a new kid that wants to have like his individualism, right, which was something that I wanted growing up, I think we all did, or at least we were, you know, pushing away from like the mainstream, what are they turning then to for influence if not other brands? If not, what's on the street?
I think, I mean, what Kala was talking about earlier, I mean, they're looking at Kanye and his team. I mean, Kanye at this point, the Kanye and the Kardashians, they are our generation's MTV. Like, they are the media channel. That's the conglomerate to watch. I mean, the most popular channel this week is DJ Khaled, right?
Sure.
But everyone is watching Kanye, not just in terms of, oh, I'm interested in him musically. They're interested in him as a persona that they're adopting. So I think they are basically mimicking or taking down from his dress. I think, I don't know Kanye personally, but I think he actually has some kind of substantive connection to culture from what I've seen through, you know, I basically, I think I'm the same age and we kind of grew up at the same time. So I know that he has a lot of that experience, but what Kyle's referring to is the younger generation who's just borrowing that, you know, oh, so-and-so's wearing a hardcore shirt, I don't know what that band is, but XYZ rapper's wearing it, so I'm going to wear it without any.
I mean, even like Virgil, like I think a lot of people are hard on him because he tried to get into the fashion streetwear world. But I mean, the fact that he did something with Babylon, you know what I mean, I think is really cool because they're doing something very authentic. You know, they're in music, they're in skate. Yeah. But he saw that and realized, hey, I like what you're doing. Yeah. I might not know a lot about, but I grew up skateboarding. And I want to learn more. And maybe he knows a lot. I don't know him, you know?
Yeah.
But, like, you know, when you go to the site of the Off-White, they're playing John Mouse. You know what I mean? And that was really cool.
Yeah.
And I think he legitimately has passion in what he's into. And he's trying to kind of, like, teach people or at least share his ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the most important thing. It's not really about clothing. The clothing is just part, it's like you said, it's part of the culture and identity. And I think the main focus for a lot of these brands should be, how do you have a perspective in the world? And how do people share that with the consumer?
I think that's where, taking it back to why we're even having this discussion in the first place, I think that's where things start to flip for the worse. And what, just for me, speaking from my own experience and doing my own brand for 12 and a half, 13 years now and seeing it through it, all of its ebbs and flows, I think all of our brands, the authentic, genuine, you know, all the marketing buzzword terms I can think of, the brands when they're first starting out, they have this intent of, I don't really care about making money. I have something to say. This is authentically tied to a real human culture that I'm immersed in. And I want to reflect that, or I want to talk about it. I want to share it with the world. When it starts becoming more about the clothing first, that's not what, to me, what how I've always understood streetwear, it had nothing to do with fashion or streetwear or apparel or actual design. Like, the design came from the heart, but without any of the heart or any of the storyline or any of the background or substantive plot behind why you're designing a piece of clothing a certain way, there was no point to it. So for me, I grew up wearing a lot of swap meet clothes. Like, I just didn't have, like, my parents didn't buy me nice clothes. And so how I dressed growing up was very work wear, very Southern California looking, Dickies, you know, Solo jeans, Ben Davis. And that was also resonating within X Large. So I loved Extra Large and how LA streetwear looked. And even within the punk and hardcore community, that's kind of the way we just adopted how to dress. And it was just a very, you know, like a very proletariat type of, you know, utilitarian workwear.
Yeah.
You know, and so there was a reason why I liked that type of clothes, because it represented something and it was functional. Just like how people are into military stuff, if it's for a certain functional reason, for me it was workwear. Now, when I design clothes for the hundreds, how I've always designed it has been inspired by that type of clothing and that aesthetic, because it actually meant something to me. Like, right. I like wearing Pendletons or shirts that look like Pendletons because of
But a lot of the Hundreds collection over the years has also touched upon interests that you've had, right? You know, you've done plenty of collections with the brands that you grew up with, and you've also worked with incredibly large commercial entities, I guess. You know, talk to me about what that balance is for you guys. You know, like, we talk about, like, the authenticity of talking about what you like, the bands you listen to, the music you listen to, the characters around your life that you've enjoyed. I'm still trying to get at the heart of, like, why brands from your wave of streetwear are able to do it, and why today it may not be as clear cut for newer brands.
Well, you know what's funny about that? It's like, I mean, when I met you, Jeff, we nerded out on music.
Right.
You know what I mean? The idea of music and how you got a hold of music and what that meant to you. Like, we didn't really talk about clothing. You know what I mean? And I think the thing about clothing, which I love, and I love talking about it, the problem is it's very a surface product. You know what I mean? Like, when you think about the good brands, you talk about the designers or you talk about the way it's made. But the item itself sometimes is not that interesting. It's part of the full picture. You know what I mean? When you talk about Raph Simons, a lot of people don't even know what he's making or, like, how he's constructing it. But the idea of him is so interesting because he's an artist.
But is the idea of him because he's been put up by, or at least co-signed by, I don't know, another musical act mentioned within a rap track?
Well, what I'm saying is, for the new consumer, yes. But the reason why I like him is because back in the day, he was referencing things that I really liked.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Before, like Bobby said, I was shopping at Thrift Town in El Cerrito in California. And I was wearing skate clothing and, like, weird poly Wrangler pants with, like, you know what I mean? And Nike SB was only, I only wore those because they had it at 510 Skate Shop and Dino Shimizu wore them. There was never, like, a hype thing. I skated all my dunks. I never had one on ice. You know what I mean? Because that wasn't my culture. You know? And I think, you know, nowadays I look at, like, when I talk about culture, what I was trying to get at was the fact that, like, when I DJ or I like DJs who play stuff, I don't know what it is. I want to go up to someone and be like, dude, what is that? I'm super psyched. You know what I mean? And I feel like nowadays, and it's actually always been this way, but brands now are like the top 40 DJs. Like, they play stuff that people want to listen to. Like, and that's cool. Like, if you want to be playing Travis Scott, that's great. Like, I like that. But at the same time, I'm just more interested in the guy who's going to play some crazy shit that I've never heard. You know what I mean? And that's what's original, you know?
Right. Bobby, when we look back to the early 2000s when you started the Hundreds, what was the environment like that was different than today? Putting aside the internet, tell me what it felt like then compared to now.
So then what was happening within our, I guess you could say, marketplace or this type of fashion sphere was that it was split between urban and skate, okay? And skate at the time was not the how skate has gotten really cool and independent and true over the last couple of years. Skate at the time was really powered by a lot of these skate shoe companies that were just doing a lot of logo slaps, $14 on the rack, PacSun type deals. And so skate, to me, I had grown up wearing skate clothing, but during the era of, like, Think and Acme and Blockhead, like, that's what I loved in skate. And so skate, to me, was not necessarily resonating. And then on the other side was urban, and the urban aesthetic was just something that I never jived with. And you didn't really have anything in the middle aside from what was happening out in Japan and New York. And obviously there was some of it everywhere in London and LA also, but really New York and Japan were powering through this by having these independent brands like Sir and, you know, even like Jeff Staple was doing his thing at the time, like all the original retail mafia guys like A-Life. It wasn't necessarily about making these $2 million trade show booths, which was what Fat Farm was doing at the time, or South Pole. It was about just having a creative outlet, which is why I loved A-Life so much. When I visited their original store on Orchard, actually, even before Rivington, was that you could see the guys working on the product within the actual design agency. And I just thought that was really cool. And just T-shirts and stuff like that. And then I would travel to Japan. So that kind of excitement was really interesting. And it was like electric for kids like me who didn't really find a place. They wanted to feel special in terms of what they wore. But they wanted to wear something that no one else in their school or their community was wearing. You know, and so like I would travel, I would save up and travel to New York to buy this stuff, hang out at the stores. I would travel to Japan, walk Harajuku, and like discover brands that I never heard before, like whatever, Neighborhood, Bape, like all those brands at the time. When we were starting brand, I was like, I want to do something like that. I have no interest in being a DC or a FUBU. I have nothing in me wants to be that. I don't even know how I would function at that level. I want to just do something that's creative and that's right now. And that's what I think streetwear really is when it gets down to what its core is. I think you can still be a big streetwear company as long as you always have that mentality of like, I want to create something. I don't really care if this is going to make money, if this is on trend, if a celebrity is going to wear it. I just want to make it because I believe in this thing right now. And it's like, it's a very romantic idea. I mean, I know this is like very passion speak. That's how I've always carried our brand and how I've always longed to think of our brand, you know? I've definitely gone off course a lot, and that's where I've ended up in a lot of situations I'm in today where I'm making moves I'm not necessarily comfortable with or making product I'm not necessarily into, and it's because I didn't follow that initial ethos of how a streetwear brand should be.
That's a pretty honest thing for you to talk about, Bobby. What is it like now for somebody that's coming up?
Coming up in streetwear?
Somebody, not even so streetwear, but somebody that wants to
start a brand.
Somebody that wants to do their own thing.
I think it's hard. I think it's a lot harder. And even when we started, we started our brand in around 2002, 2003. And I remember the first trade show that we walked was, I think it was one of the very first agendas. It was in LA. And everyone we knew that was in the space was telling us, do not do this. There are too many t-shirt brands out there. You guys are smart kids. Go off and do something else. They were telling us that 12 and a half, 13 years ago. Okay, so this has always been a problem. The difference now is that everyone's attention spans are shorter. And that is hyper-accelerated. I have to blame the internet and social media for that. And so when I wrote that piece for Hypebeast, one of the strongest critiques was, you sound like an old bitter man that is bummed out that all these new brands are moving in. And I was like, no, no, no. My advice that I'm giving through this article, or my warning, applies to the young brands as well. Because what I was saying there was, there are brands that I like right now that are literally months old that everybody's talking about. This never used to happen. So even if you're a brand that started today, in months from now, there's going to be a new competitor that you didn't have to deal with. We invested 3-4 years into the brand before we started turning a profit. You know, another 4 years before we really started seeing real competition. I mean, this took time. And for brands before our generation, like the Quiksilvers and the Echoes, they had 20 years to build businesses like this that reached hundreds of millions of dollars. Those days are gone. The days of the hundreds and crooks and how we built our businesses and how long we got to last, those days are gone. And now the next generations of Kyle's brand, Braindead and Babylon's and Born and Raised, even for those guys, I'm genuinely concerned for them. It's not about money. It's about how long I want to see them be able to go. But when I hear kids already talking about, yeah, Braindead's cool, yeah, but have you seen this?
Right.
I'm like, damn, Braindead didn't even get his moment in the sun. So that's the thing that bothers me.
So a consequence of the speed of the internet is this idea that things just flip over a lot quicker. And I hate to sound like an old man, because you can still do this. When you walked into a store to go buy a piece of music, you would sit on that music and play through that for weeks at a time before, I don't know, your next paycheck. And So there's, you know, there's some hyper acceleration that's happening with the music industry. It's funny because I find myself rarely, and the only way that I can stop myself from doing this is actually putting a physical CD into a machine. It's so hard for me not to want to flip to the next track, right? And I can understand that for a specific generation of kids today, I think about two things specifically. One is when they land on something that they find unique, do they think about who in their own environment is into it or not? And do they then want to move out of that immediately and try to find something else? And I'm wondering if, because things are so fast and things move really quickly and get hyped, and almost actually stay insular within certain ecosystems. You know, you think about like Instagram brands. There's a lot of brands that don't even have websites. You know, they solely exist on Instagram. You know, how quickly kids latch onto things, find it, and then move away from them.
I mean, I think the thing is, too, I don't think there's an issue with, like, Instagram brands or, like, that there's so many brands. My thing is this. I think that, like, for the brands itself, they have to be smarter.
Yeah.
You know, for us...
New and old.
Yeah, new and old. Bobby's was the first generation of, like, turning massive profits off, like, a streetwear brand. Mm-hmm. Like, you look at Diamond. They were a hardware company, and now they're, like, a massive company. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? At that point, when you're turning millions of dollars, you have to hire more and more people to run the company. You know what I mean? And then you get in your head, like, dude, I'm making all this money. You know what I mean? And then it changes your perspective of how you're living life.
Yeah.
For where I am, you know... I'm still doing a bunch of jobs, like, and I like it. Like, I'm shooting video. I'm doing design for other people. I'm doing art shows and everything. And to me, because Braindead has to stay as part of my lifestyle and not a business. And if it becomes a business, that's great. And if I could survive off it, that's amazing. But at the end of the day, it's so important to make sure that it stays authentic to what we want to make and also kind of portray or convey an idea of what we think the brand is. I'm obsessed with comic books and art books, and I'll spend hundreds of dollars on them because it's that object and what it represents. And I think that's the thing that I think brands should remember is that when someone's buying your product, it's not really a product, actually. It's just an object that represents everything you're creating in your world of what the brand should live in. You know what I mean? If you're a punk brand, you know, I buy stuff. I love Babylon because, you know, Lee lives his life. He's skating. He has all the kids over there. You know, he lets all these, like, troubled youth kind of just skate whenever for free, giving them shoes and skateboards.
Yeah.
And that's punk, you know? Like, I knew him since I was a kid, but I love what he's doing, and I think that's important. There's no part of it where it was like, hey, I'm going to make $1 million. This is my, like, business model. You know, not saying it's bad to have a business model, but he's just doing it because it's authentic.
Conversations was produced by me, Taj Reed, and Jeff Carvalho. Special thanks to our guests, Dion Point, Brian White, Omar Kiambao, Aaron Levant, Bobby Kim, and Kyle Ng. Our music is provided by Shy Guy. You can find this and other episodes at our website, heistnobody.com/podcasts, or on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. We'll be back soon with the second episode of Heist Nobody Conversations. Thanks for listening.